George, but my Buddhist ordained name is Thupten Sultram. Can you say that? So that's why I say, just call me George. Some of the members have names that are more easy, like, you know, Geshe Lao or something. Thupten Sultram is a little difficult on the tongue. So welcome. I'm going to be talking about some of these basic Buddhist subjects in the next couple of weeks, next few weeks. And this series, starting today, is going to dwell upon the first teaching that the Buddha gave, sort of defining characteristics of Buddhism, called the Four Noble Truths. Right? What else? What other names have you heard? Maybe if you've taken teachings from in other centers, do they use other names here in Singapore for? They say the Four Noble Truths. So before we begin, I'd like to take a minute for us just to do a little quiet meditation. And you were, as I came in, you were sitting very quietly. You weren't chatting back and forth, so your probably minds are pretty quiet already. But let's begin. And within that, the purpose for doing this at the very beginning is to clear away other thoughts, preoccupations, and also to try to, within that quiet state of mind, to set a good motivation. Motivation in the sense that why I am here this morning, what I'm planning to achieve from sitting here this morning. So one of the quintessential ways of quieting the mind like that, the Buddha taught, was mindfulness on the breathing, on the respiration. Many, many of the sutras that are accounts of the Buddha's teachings, they would relate that he had gone into the village in the morning to receive alms, you know, for... Sometimes people say begging, but that begging is different than going for alms. Alms is something that's honoring the donor, giving them the opportunity to offer to the monks. So he would go in for alms, have some food, eat, and he would sit down. He would wash his feet. He would sit down. And many of the sutras say the same formula. He would place his attention on the breathing in front. Places mindfulness on the breathing. So that means as we're breathing, you breathe through your nose if you haven't a cold. If you've got a cold, you can breathe through your mouth. And sit comfortably with your spine erect. I think most of you are adept at that. And just put your attention on the breath itself as it's coming in, and as it just stops and begins to go out, as it goes out, and again, that juncture where it changes directions at the end. And whatever thoughts arise in your mind, hindering you from watching that breathing only, as though that's your only task, let those other thoughts go. You can keep your eyes partially open. Don't control the breath. Just passively observe it. be aware when it's going in, when it's coming in. And likewise, notice, be aware of the fact that it's going out when you're breathing out. If you still notice some conversation going on in your mind or some thoughts or preoccupations, place your attention more firmly on the breathing and let go of those other thoughts. Try to watch every detail of the breathing. Then within that quiet state of mind, try to set a motivation, thinking that I'm going to take part this morning, not simply to accumulate intellectual knowledge, but to really begin to change my mind, my life, to benefit myself and others, to listen with an open heart, an open mind, like the lotus in the morning as the leaves open, as you're listening to the teachings, let it penetrate your heart. And think that I'm doing this as an ultimate healing for myself and for others. That I can become a better person, less problematic for others, more understanding, more loving, more compassionate, and more wise. If you already have an understanding or belief that there is a way out of these problems we all endure, liberation, enlightenment, I think I'm going to be listening to the teachings, participating in order to achieve liberation and enlightenment, not just for some temporal aims, but for myself and all other beings. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. Sure. Yeah. Would you like? Yeah. So our director is going to give some introductions now that your mind is calm. Your minds are calm.
Good.
Good morning. It doesn't seem to be.
Hello.
Why don't you check this?
Good morning. Venerable George, good morning, Venerable Dhamma brothers and sisters. We welcome you this morning to this wonderful series of talks, starting with today on the Four Noble Truths. I'd just like to share a few information about Venerable George. Venerable George is not a stranger to Amitabha Buddhist Center. I believe Venerable George has been coming here for the last maybe 15 years. Maybe longer, 20 years. And as you know, Venerable George is a very much loved and very well respected teacher, scholar, and also a great translator of the Tibetan language into English. I think much of the early works of in our FBMT publications, a lot of the translation was actually completed by Venerable George in the early 70s, I believe. In those days, yes, when there's not so much availability of the Dharma, Tibetan Dharma knowledge in the English language. And I believe Venerable George was one of the early pioneers of this translation. I think the Nyungne text that we all used recently, that was also translated by you from Tibetan into English for the first time, I believe, yes? So really, we all you a lot, Venerable George, for all the texts and all the practices we do today. It's only been possible because of all the hard work that you put it into translating these texts into the English language for us to use. So really, we really very delighted, and we really with open arms and a very big heart, we welcome you to Amitabha Buddhist Center to start this series of talks for our Dharma students here. So without much ado, so Venerable, please, thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hubching, Brother Hubching. I think I came to Amitabha Buddhist Center for the first time when, along with Lama Ussel, who was the reincarnation of Lama Yeshe, when I was teaching him at the monastery in South India at Sarah. And it's got to be 20 years ago, something like that, I think, yeah, something like that. So, there's much to say about the background of when the Buddha first gave his first teaching. But I'll just give a very, very brief summary and then go into that teaching. As you may know, the human being that we know as the Buddha, we usually say the Buddha. Of course, we recognize that there are numberless beings that have become omniscient, have become Buddha. But the person that we refer to as the Buddha generally in our era was born to a royal family in an area that is now in Nepal. It was sort of a more amorphous area at the time, part of general India. He was born to a royal family with sort of remarkable circumstances, a little bit like the stories we hear about Christ's birth, amazing things that are taking place celestially, that wise men came to make offerings. So there were similar things happening at the time when this child was being born to the king. And he exhibited remarkable qualities as a child and was prophesied by the wise men of the time in the court of the king that this young boy was indeed destined to do very great things. He would either become a universal monarch that would help to unify the reign over all of the lands. Maybe at that point that meant mainly over the areas of India. What would they call a Chakravartin king? That gladdened the king very much that his son might have that destiny because the king's kingdom was a little bit smaller than that. The wise man said, though, on the other hand, he might leave all of this behind, all of his royal trappings, and become an enlightened one, a Buddha. That word was known in India. It means someone whose understanding has blossomed totally. That didn't appeal to the king as much as having his son become a Chakravartin. So he'd, a universal king. So he'd set about means to try to keep the young boy, his son, who was named very soon after his birth, Siddhartha. Did you know that? That's the name of Siddhartha Gautama. He set about various means to entice him to remain in the royal life. All of the luxuries, beautiful friends, the most delightful foods, various residences within the royal compound for the various seasons. They would change. But to make a story that I might elaborate in more detail later, when we, maybe at the time of the New Year, we might talk a little bit about the Buddha's lives. I'll shorten a little bit right now. He very famously, on four occasions, left the compound, a little bit secretly from his father. His father didn't want him to leave, to see the sort of seamy underworld of Kapalavastu. That was the name of the kingdom city. So he went out with his faithful attendant, and he saw on successive visits into the city things that disturbed him. At one time he saw some people that were obviously sick, moaning in various degrees of writhing around and so forth. And he asked his attendant, because he'd always been sheltered from anything like this, from seeing anything that wasn't totally beautiful and royal and pristine. He said, "What is this?" And his attendant said, "Oh Lord, this is these people are suffering illness, sickness." And from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha already knew this. This was kind of like at Christmas. Do you have a Christmas tradition here? Santa Claus, some uncle comes down the stairs as Santa Claus. You know, the children don't know that that is Uncle Harry or Uncle Wong or whatever, but the adults all know, and they're playing along. Oh, Santa Claus. And Santa Claus, of course, is pretending to be Santa Claus. So the Buddha was taking the aspect of being surprised, like, sickness? What is this? Does this happen to many people? And the attendant said, "Oh Lord, this happens to everyone. Everyone that lives at some time or another experiences some kind of sickness, some illness." And he took this seriously, you know, like, wow, sobering kind of thing. Came back to the temple, and on another occasion went out, and he saw people that were old and wretched, like me, with a long stick, you know, walking, skin sagging, can't see so well, can't hear so well. And he asked his attendant what this was, and the attendant told him this was, these people were aging. Even Siddhartha's father, although he was much older than his son, wasn't exhibiting these kinds of extremes. And again, he took it to heart, went back, and was seen to be contemplating that I too, as the servant said, you too, Lord, will grow old and have this same kind of experience. Third occasion, he saw someone being taken with these things you carry the dead body on, stretcher, we say today. And he asked what this was, and the attendant told him this was a person who had died. Again, the Buddha said, this has happened often. And what do we think about it? Have you thought about it today? That you're going to die? Probably not. Maybe some of you who have been, you have received teachings about the importance of thinking about impermanence and the inevitability of death may have thought about it today, but it really is this very sobering thought. I'm going to die. I'm definitely going to have to leave all of this behind, all of the, whatever grandiosity I might achieve, achievements or whatever, happiness, I'm going to have to leave it all behind. And so he contemplated on this. And finally, the fourth, coming out of four different gates on these different occasions of the compound, fourth occasion, he saw an individual in robes, not exactly like this, but, you know, the robes different than the ordinary people, who was going for alms. And he asked the attendant what this was, and he said, oh, this person is a renunciate. They have renounced the ordinary worldly life to seek the solution to sickness, aging, and death. Is there a way out of this? Do we have to get sick? Do we have to age? Do we have to die? And understanding at that time, as you probably do in the Chinese culture here, that after death there would come another life, reincarnation. In the West, it's not so common that people automatically accept the existence of future lives and that there were past lives. How many people here don't accept at the moment? You know, you're not convinced that there are past and future lives. One. Oh, come on. There's got to be more than one person. But that's very interesting. People in America, for instance, it would probably be the opposite. There would be maybe one person or five people that believed, had confidence that we would be reborn again after this lifetime. So the Buddha eventually left home. Again, there are more incidences. He had gotten, his father had arranged for a marriage, had a child already. He left home and began to search. He gave back his royal garments, cut his long, beautiful braids, shaved his head, and began to search for the sages that existed in India at the time that purported to teach ways to escape from this dilemma. Basically, just these three, mainly these three things, being as a renunciate to search for a solution to sickness, aging, and death. He studied with the greatest teachers that taught concentration, single-pointed concentration, asceticism of various ways, and finally was not satisfied with the solutions that they were proposing. He'd actually exhausted their methods and found that they didn't lead to a solution to this. So he set out himself with five individuals that he had associated with in this kind of endeavor. And they went to an area near Bodh Gaya in India. In fact, right now, today, I think His Holiness the Dalai Lama is teaching in Bodh Gaya. Have you been? Anyone been to Bodh Gaya? A couple? Oh, you're Indian, so that's it. They sat for many years, and the Buddha even engaged in extreme asceticism, living on just for a certain period of time, just one berry a day. Became emaciated, trying to meditate to find a solution out of this, and at a certain point, in bathing himself, trying to bathe himself in the river, he fell and almost drowned and realized that he had been going too extreme. The other extreme that he'd had as a youth was this royal life of indulgence and pleasures and so forth. Now he had gone to the other extreme of not taking any kind of good nutrition, just living on the meanest, having just a simple one cloth to keep warm and so forth. So he tried to settle on a middle way, which was a theme that pervaded all of his teachings. Again, this was kind of a demonstration already envisioned by the Buddha, already planned by the Buddha, how to teach. He took some nutrition, some food that was offered to him, and sat down to meditate and achieved what is renowned to be called achieved enlightenment, and recognized the solution, how to escape from this cycle of birth, sickness, aging, death, after death again, birth, is aging, sickness, death. And he spent some days afterwards in Bodh Gaya just contemplating that and thinking, this solution is very difficult to understand. There are very few people who could do it and who could understand, so I might as well just keep my, so we would say today, at least in American slang, I might as well keep my mouth shut, my clap shut. What would you say here? Keep my mouth shut? But he was encouraged by celestial beings that there were some people whose wisdom eyes were only slightly covered with dust, that there were people in the world that were receptacles to this teaching that he should teach. The five individuals that he had sat with in Bodh Gaya, who had left him when he began to take this middle way approach of not extreme asceticism, he sought them out, walked many miles from Bodh Gaya to Varanasi, and if you know, that's a good trek on foot. And he found them, and as he began to approach, he found them in an area in Sarnath that was sometimes called Deer Park. Sometimes it was called Rishipatana. Do you know that name, Rishipatana? Do you know the story why it's called that? Oh, maybe there were, you know what rishis are? You know the Indian word rishi? Like Maharishi? You've heard of Maharishi and Mahashyogi or some. Maharishi means great teacher, right? Maharishi. Rishi is someone who's very realized, whose words are very powerful, a saint. So there were, at an earlier time, there were a certain number of rishis that lived there who were actually a kind of Buddhist practitioner called Pratika Buddhas. They weren't Buddhas yet, but they had made vows in previous lives not to achieve their enlightenment in the presence of another teacher, a Buddha. They would do it by themselves. Know people like that. I'm going to do it myself. I don't need any kind of guidance. And they were informed by, again, celestial beings that a Buddha was about to be born in the world. And they decided, okay, we're splitting. We're leaving. So they rose with their psychic powers. They rose in the air and meditated on the element of fire. And their bodies combusted spontaneously, burned up. Their minds, of course, continued on. And their ashes fell onto this area, this garden, this Deer Park area. And that's why it was, one of the other names of it was Rishipatana, where the rishis fell, the ashes of the rishis fell from the sky. So as the Buddha was approaching, the five disciples were there, and they saw him coming, and they said, here is that turncoat Siddhartha. You know, he's taking food, he's getting flesh back on his body. Let's ignore him. No one get up and offer him a seat, nothing. But just by the aura of the Buddha as he was approaching, independent of their sort of resolution not to pay him any attention because they considered him no longer to be following this ascetic path, they got up, they offered him a seat, and he began to teach them the very first Dharma discourse that the Buddha gave was on these four truths that are the topic today. The very first thing he said is, this suffering, this is dukkha. Do you know that word, dukkha? Is it? I think here, because of the influence of probably some Sanskrit, but Indonesian also, there's a lot of Sanskrit words that we know of, so you know. What does dukkha mean to you? You know the word dukkha? Suffering? Some? Huh? I couldn't hear. Unsatisfaction. Dissatisfaction. Yeah. Unsatisfaction, dissatisfaction. Unsatisfactory. Some people in the West, when they're explaining the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, they'll say that unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfactoriness, but I'd like to say that just cut to the bone, suffering. So if we just say, the Buddha said, this is suffering, you might say, well, actually, I don't feel so bad. I was to the fitness center this morning. I had my protein shake. I was at the spa. I'm feeling pretty good. I just got a raise. So that's not exactly what the Buddha meant at all. In fact, a lot of Western people who superficially study Buddhism, and they, especially people of other religions, they superficially think that the Buddha was referring to only these obvious sufferings of sickness, aging, death, and you know, misfortune of various kinds. What the Buddha meant was that while we are still in this, under the influence of our uncontrolled mind, taking rebirth, dying, taking rebirth again and again, under the influence of our actions, that is to say, our karma. You know the word karma too, right? What does karma mean? Do you know? To say karma. You're shy. You know, or you're just shy? Right, karma in Sanskrit means action. One of the ways of translating it, action. So when we say you've created good karma, it means you've created good actions. What are considered good actions? Actions that are not motivated by our selfish self-interest, attachment, not motivated by attachment for ourselves, you know, wanting to get some pleasure or fame or fool others or to get our loved one or to keep our loved one only for ourselves alone. Hatred is another kind of negative karma. Hatred and anger, when we speak out, we lose our temper, we say harsh words and so forth. Jealousy, pride, a myriad of different kinds of mental states that lead to negative actions. Actions can be eventually exhibited physically. You can strike out, or positively, you can gently calm others or embrace. You can create both negative and positive actions depending on your state of mind. You can create, you can exhibit those actions through your speech also, not just your bodily functions, by saying nice things or harsh words, by telling the truth or lying, by bringing people together in harmony or splitting them in schism. So while we're still under the influence of having created actions like this through our uncontrolled mind, we create actions. Those actions, the Buddha said, and was understood by the culture at the time in India, they leave imprints in our mind, like having sown seeds into a field. They leave seeds or imprints in our mind, karmic seeds, you could say. Those karmic seeds are not, they do change, so you could call them karma, but they are the residue of the karma that are left there until the right conditions arise in the future. And when the right conditions arise, they provide the fundamental cause for us to experience pleasure, suffering, or just an indifferent state, depending on what kind of actions we produced. Positive actions lead to pleasurable experiences, such as, let me just take a sip of water here, such as a sip of water when your throat is dry. Fortunately, I had some karma left to experience that pleasure. To be born as a human is a fruition, a ripening of virtuous karma that we've created in the past. To be born as an animal or as a ghost of some kind or as a hell being is a residue, is a maturation, a ripening of negative karma that we've created in the past. We can have mixed karma. We can be born as a human, which was basically something that threw us into that existence, was a positive action. But we might have a miserable human existence. We probably see, we may know people who have all sorts of problems in their lives. Other karmas that are completing that human rebirth, not just being born as a human, having been born as a human was the result of having done something virtuous in the past, something with a virtuous mind, positive mind. But completing that life may have been other negative karmas that we've created from stealing in the past lives. Maybe now we're destitute or we have our things stolen. If we've harmed others in the past, maybe we ourselves are incarcerated or beaten as a child or molested or many, many different things. So when the Buddha said, this is suffering, he was referring to the fact that our lives, this uncontrolled taking of rebirth again and again, which is called samsara in the Indian language. The particular, there are other words that are also used, but that's that's the one that became very famed in the Buddhist cosmology, samsaric existence. This taking of rebirth again and again without control. At our monastery, Geshe Chuni, the abbot the main teacher here, is the abbot of our monastery in Nepal called Kopan. And when I was a monk there in the early, mid-70s, 74, 75, 76, 77, around there, the Western Sangha had our own little living quarters, and there was a bathroom, sort of one of these drop toilets, you know, it's just a big pit with two boards on top, but it was enclosed, one for the men and one for the women. And they were labeled Sam and Sarah. Samsara, right? So that was very clever at the time, you know, the people were thinking. You know? And it was very appropriate also, because when you looked down into the toilet, you saw this is suffering. So what did the Buddha mean in particular when he said, this is suffering? When explained in detail, the Buddha explained that there are three main levels of suffering. The obvious suffering that he called the dukkha dukkha, suffering of suffering, you might say, or the suffering of unsatisfactoriness, or the unsatisfactoriness of suffering, or the unsatisfactoriness of unsatisfactoriness, however you want to translate dukkha. What that means is what we obviously understand is suffering. You've cut yourself. Like last night, for a couple of nights, my shoulder, because I flew in, it took 36 hours to fly, I don't know why, to get here from my house and from door to door. So I had some pain in my shoulder. My muscle was sort of cramped up, and it was like, ooh, excruciating, painful. That, you know, have you experienced something like that? Real pain, you know, a toothache or a headache or incredible unhappiness. Your friend has left you. Or like in the soap operas, you know. Was it Brangelina? Brad Pitt and Angelina. You know, someone splits up, you know, obvious suffering we all understand, and we would like to be free of it. What we'd like, generally, what we all would like to have is pleasure and happiness, right? We can differentiate within our own continuum between pain and pleasure, right? Is there any kind of being that can't? Maybe, you would have to say, if someone was immune, if you stuck in a pin and they didn't react and you put on a soothing lotion and a wonderful scent, they didn't react, you would have to say they weren't experiencing those, because if they are experiencing them, they would be able to differentiate between pain and pleasure, right? Do you agree? No? So we generally think of pleasure as not being suffering, not dukkha. But when the Buddha said, this is suffering, this is dukkha, he was referring to also what we call pleasure. Now, some of you who have studied before, read about Buddhism, you may know this. The Buddha referred to what we call happiness, pleasure. He referred to this as changeable suffering. You've heard that before, right? Suffering of change. Okay, we've got I know who to go for a resource for an old student. Good student. Suffering of change, changeable suffering. What this means, superficially it sounds like this. If you have this pleasure, it's not immutable, it's not unchanging. It will definitely eventually change into suffering. But that's not the final meaning of that. Say, for instance, right now, as you go out into the Singapore streets, especially if you're walking quickly or running to catch the bus or something, you might begin sweating and you're hot and you feel uncomfortable. When you get into the taxi that might be, or the bus might be air conditioned, you go, oh. There is a diminishing of that suffering of hot, of heat. But unbeknownst to you, there's a slow increase of the suffering of coolness. While the larger suffering of hot is going down, it's still larger than the suffering of the cold, you experience that change as pleasure, as relief. Ah, oh, wow, fantastic. You know, once you've sat in front of that, maybe the air conditioner is blowing out on you, once the suffering of the cold has exceeded the suffering of the heat, the heat has abated in your body a little, and your body is now becoming a little bit cold, and you start to say, oh, can you turn off the air conditioner? I mean, turn the fan in a different direction, you know, the vane of the blower in a different direction. The Buddha said, and if you investigate this today, tomorrow, next week, everything that we experience is pleasure, that we anticipate, that we plan for, that we want to get as pleasure, is no more than the diminishing of one suffering, replacing it with another suffering that will eventually change into obvious suffering. See, suffering of heat, suffering of cold, both we would like to avoid. It's only for that short instance of interface between one going down and the other being replacing it that we experience that relief that we call pleasure. What do you think? Does it make sense? I taught once in Holland. I was there teaching for some time, and the one university, I think it was in Leiden, or Leiden, however it's pronounced, one of the big cities there. Maybe it was the capital, I can't remember. There was a university. So I was teaching at a seminar. A professor was teaching about development, all kinds of financial development, rural development, and then my talk was going to be on mental development or spiritual development. So there was a big audience, bigger than this, in an auditorium, and people in suits, old people. And when I explained about this, that what we call happiness was actually the nature, was of an unsatisfactory nature. It really wasn't what we really expected it to be, real pleasure, something like, real steak right there, big beef steak. Like, that's real pleasure. Have you ever eaten too much? The pizza or, I mean, so this is Singapore, is it? What's your favorite dish? What's your favorite dish? Food. You don't have one? You don't eat anything? Too much? No. Who has a favorite dish? Come on, tell me. I need to know what people are eating in Singapore now. Chicken rice? Yeah, of course. My favorite also. So, someone brings this nice chicken rice, little side, what is it called, pickled vegetables and steamy rice and nice greasy chicken. But when you first begin to eat that, you'll experience some pleasure. But if you keep on eating, you may get bloated and at a certain point feel some discomfort. This is what we call changeable suffering. That all of the pleasures that we have in life, all of the, let's say, the fame that we have, or the high status that we achieve, that we might think, that we may have worked for because we thought that this would bring us pleasure. All of the outer things, whether they be physical or just in the terms of status or hearing sweet words of others telling us that they love us or whatever, all of these things that we think bring us pleasure, all they can do is ameliorate, lower one suffering by replacing it with another. Say, for instance, if I were to sit in front of you and say, I love you. Maybe at first, and saying sincerely, to say, at first we might feel, oh, that's nice. Even the second, third, fourth time, But if we had to sit there, we're strapped down, and we had to hear this continuously, at a certain point, it no longer brings us pleasure. In fact, it can maybe even get irritating. Did you have a question? Oh, you were scratching your head. Okay. I thought you were... You had a question. So I liked to give the example. And now is not so much in vogue. Richard Gere. Do you remember Richard Gere, the movie star? Some time ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago when I would be here, he was still the very handsome movie star that women would swoon over. So if you'd say, you know, imagine embracing Richard Gere, I'd say to the women in the crowd. I mentioned this once when I was teaching in Tokyo, and in meditation I said, imagine embracing Richard Gere. And I could hear from somewhere in the back, I heard, you know, like real pleasure, you know, just in imagination. But if you can imagine, just imagine this, or you know, if you're a man, imagine embracing some beautiful woman. If you were you were embracing and you couldn't stop, you would get sweaty. You know, after some hours, the breath of your companion would get bad smelling, perspiration. Your arms would ache. You no longer would be physically excited. It would actually be painful. It would transform into suffering, change into suffering. Of suffering. But from the subtle point of it is that I mentioned before, this not just that it eventually will change into suffering, from the very moment it's happening, none of it is really satisfying. It's just exchanging one suffering, say the desire for physical contact that's being diminished by being in contact with someone, by the suffering of physical contact. Or the diminishing of hunger by having food. Sooner or later, the suffering of food is recognized. So the Buddha was referring to this phenomena that if you begin to investigate all the things that we invest so much importance into as our goals, because they will bring us pleasure, the pleasure that we're anticipating is not what we are envisioning it to be, real pleasure. It's really changeable suffering. It's the kind of dukkha. That's the second kind of suffering. So suffering of suffering, changeable suffering. And then the Buddha said there's a third kind of suffering that you might say is associated with neutral feelings. Suffering of suffering is what we associate with unpleasant feelings. Changeable suffering is what we associate with pleasurable feelings. They're not real pleasure. They will, at that very moment, they're transforming. They are of the nature of suffering. They are changeable suffering. There's a third kind of experience associated with neutral feelings where you don't feel pleasure nor pain. Just sort of like right now, if I ask you, how does the tip of your nose feel? No. It's not bad, it's not good, it's kind of neutral, right? If I ask you how your arm feels, maybe if your arm is like my left arm, you might say, well, it hurts, but my right arm, not particularly pleasurable, not particularly painful, it's just neutral, you know, neutral feeling. One of my teachers in America, Geshe Zopa, a great teacher, the same name as Lama Sopa, except he spelled it in English, he spelled it with an S, Sopa. Lama Sopa spells it with a Z, like Zorro, right? I think that's very, very good. Zorro. You don't know who Zorro is? No. So Geshe Zopa, when he would say neutral, because he's Tibetan. Even though he's been in America many years, he started talking about noodles. It sounded like he was saying noodle suffering. A neutral feeling, noodle feeling. He said, "No, I don't mean Chinese noodle. Neutral." So there is a kind of suffering that the Buddha explained was the simply having a body and mind that was under the influence still of our actions, our karma, and our delusions, that was going to continue taking us into this cycle of samsara, sickness, aging, death, rebirth, sickness, aging, death. Simply having a body and mind that is under the influence of that, even if you're just sitting there in a sort of equipoise state with no particular feelings of pleasure or pain, that is definitely unsatisfactory. You need to get out of samsara. That's the imperative the Buddha... Well, that's what all of the Indians at the time were, of the time that Siddhartha was living in the world, when the Buddha was here, that was the main enterprise of the yogis and the yoginis, the renunciates, to get out of samsara. What was the method? No one knew the method. So the Buddha was explaining the method in this first discourse. First he explained the situation, so it became crystal clear. This is suffering. This experience that we have, what we may think of as sometimes pleasurable in life, sometimes suffering, sometimes neutral, all of this is unsatisfactory. All of it is of the nature of dukkha. And if you recognize it, we want to get out of that. Is there a solution to that? Well, if you're sick, and I coming over on the plane, I picked up something, you know, the air recycled in the airplanes and everything. I've got some sore throat. So Hub Ching, who introduced earlier, the director of the center, he took me to his physician in Tempanese late at night, and the doctor first asked the symptoms, you know, what's happening. And he listened to my heart and everything. So we have to do the same thing. And then he prescribed some medication. So in the same way that a doctor operates, the Buddha first asked the person to recognize their symptoms, that we're suffering, that we'd like to alleviate this suffering. We're seeking a solution to this. And in order to understand a solution, one has to find out what the causes of that suffering is. That's what the examination is for. The doctor, I can't just come in and say, I'm suffering. I've got pain, give me some medication. He wants to examine what's the cause of the suffering, right? He said he determined through his examination it wasn't bacterial. I must have picked up a virus or something. You know, if it was bacterial, what would he have prescribed? Antibiotic. That was the first thing I said. Can you give me an antibiotic? He said, no, it's not bacterial. There's no use. So you need to know what the causes of the suffering are to give the right prescription. Chicken soup, lots of liquids, you know, this sort of thing. So the first truth that the Buddha taught was this is suffering. The second noble truth, the truth, what we call the truth of suffering, the second teaching he gave, the second truth, not this at a different time, but just what is the cause of this suffering? What's the origin of this suffering? The truth of origination, or the truth of the cause of suffering. He said, our suffering has two causes, karma and klesha. I'll throw these words at you because you know a little bit of Sanskrit words. Karma, you know, we talked about before, means action. Actions are of the body, the speech, or the mind. They leave imprints in our mind, and when those imprints, like seeds, when they ripen, they can bring about pleasure, pain, or indifference, you know, neutral feeling. Not neutral feeling, neutral feeling. But what causes our karma? What causes us to act in various ways? It's our unsubdued mind, which in one of the many words in India, in Sanskrit, that refers to it, that is used in Buddhist philosophy, is klesha. You can say delusions. This has been translated many ways. No one's really satisfied with these things when you angered repulsion, when you want to keep something away from you that's unpleasant to you. And let's say bewilderment or ignorance, where you are unaware. You just do something, maybe you slaughter animals, not recognizing that there will be some karmic consequence of that. Not having anger at the cow that you're slaughtering, or the chicken, or whatever. So the Buddha said the cause of all of our suffering was karma and delusion, actions and delusions, or karma and klesha. So this is this will be the topic of one of the other set of lectures I'll be talking about. If you take a look, if you're interested, if you have not had a chance to study that, I think that's on one of the other series of talks that I'll be giving in the next 2 months here. Especially about delving into all of the different kinds of distorted states of mind. We might not consider them distorted. We might consider, well, my anger is good. That's what protects me. Is there anyone here who feels that their anger is something they don't want to get rid of? Well, you probably don't. You're shy to say, because you probably think. Some of you, if you're like me, probably think that's, you know, sometimes we think that's what protects me, because that's what rises up and, you know, they say, if I didn't get angry, they would take advantage of me. You know, the person on the street, the taxi driver who, you give them $100 Singapore dollar note and they pretend it was a 10, they give you change for 10, you know. They give you just $5 back rather than 95. And you say, if I didn't get angry, they would take advantage of me. Anger, you have to be able to differentiate between anger and being decisive. You know, you could recognize this and say, no, I gave you a $100 bill without getting angry. Anger is when your mind becomes uncontrolled, disturbed. The calmness of the mind is lost. That's a distinguishing characteristic of all of the klesha. A disturbance of the calmness of the mind, the tranquility of the mind that may have been there a moment before. So the evolution of our suffering is, because we have these uncontrolled minds still, we haven't found a solution to get rid of anger, attachment, ignorance, pride, jealousy, all of these, you know, low self-esteem, all of these different things. Because of it, not having control of that, we create karma. That karma leaves imprints, seeds in our mind stream that then bring about the events of our lives. They bring about our rebirths, and they fill in all the details of our rebirths. When we encounter things that are pleasant, if we have the karma to experience pleasure, we experience momentary pleasure. You know, the cool breeze when you're hot, ameliorating the heat. But that cool, after some time, we might say, oh, let me put on a sweater, and, you know, it's getting a little bit cool. That's one of the classic examples of that changeable suffering. You know, you're sitting out in the you're sitting in the shade at the picnic, and you feel a little bit cool, and you say, let's go sit in the nice warm sun. You go out there and you feel nice, it begins to warm up. You know, the suffering of, say, the suffering of cold goes down. I'll use the same hand for cold. Suffering of cold goes down. Suffering of heat goes up. As soon as the suffering of heat is noticeable above the suffering of the cool, you say, oh, let's go sit in the nice, cool shade. When you look at the shade, it looks attractive now. Before, it looked unattractive because you were too cool there. So that's the evolution. The uncontrolled mind, the kleshas, create karma that bring about all of our existence, our unsatisfactory existence within samsara, cyclic existence. So those first two truths, why did the Buddha call them truths? There are many kinds of truths. These were what the Buddha called truths for Arya beings, noble beings. Have you heard the word Arya? What does Arya mean? Pardon? Noble, nobleman or noble. There's some, when you talk about the evolution of Sanskrit and the Indo-European languages, the word Arya sometimes associated with the race that came up from the Caucasus that moved into northern India many, many millennia ago, lighter complexion, and as they came down bringing their new traditions, they referred to themselves as the Aryas, the noble, the white color, compared to the Dravidians, the darker complexion people of the south. There's some tradition like that. But Arya at the time of the Buddha generally meant, as you said, someone who was noble. The Buddha said nobility, or someone who is an Arya, is not determined by birth or complexion or occupation. It's dependent on the mind. The real Aryas, the real noble beings, are people who have perceived these four truths that he was explaining. The first of two that we've mentioned, the truth of suffering and the truth of the origin of suffering. The real Aryas are the people who've perceived these truths pristinely, directly, know these to be true so obviously. Those are the people who are endeavoring to get out of samsara. They have the method to get out of samsara. They've begun to do it. And they are the real people that are qualified to be called noble beings. So that's why when the name is given the Four Noble Truths, sometimes it might lead to misconception as though these truths themselves have some nobility. Really, the etymology of why they're called the Arya truths has to do with the mental state of the person who's perceiving them. These are truths for Arya beings. They're not necessarily truths for us. Right now, if you offer me a nice cup of coffee with cream, I will accept that thinking it's pleasure. I'm not an Arya being. I don't recognize that as suffering, you know. I mean, Arya being will also drink the tea, the coffee, right? But not with the same anticipation that I do, that it's real pleasure, only to be disappointed later when it gets a little bit bitter, or, you know, when I've drank too much. So the four truths for Arya beings, they function, as you study about them, they function to ennoble us, so you could call them ennobling truths, even though we haven't realized them directly. But anyway, they're called the four Arya truths, the four noble truths. So what are the next two? The first two were, let's say, the problem. Suffering and the cause of suffering. The second two truths are the solution. That there is an end to suffering. It's possible to cease suffering, to have a cessation of suffering. That's what the Buddha referred to in many different words. One of the words that he used was nirvana. Have you heard that word? Have you heard that word before? No, who's turning around? Yeah. Have you heard that word nirvana? What does it mean? Enlightenment? Can kind of mean that. But there's, in the Buddhist philosophy, and the word was prevalent at the time of the Buddha through other religious systems, it meant an escape from samsara, nirvana. One of the etymologies of it was like the snuffing out of a flame. Like if you have a little lamp and you put a cup on top of it to deprive it of oxygen, the lamp goes out, right? So one understanding of nirvana was, and within the Buddhist tradition, was simply stopping, ceasing the delusions, the klesha. So you no longer created karma, you no longer took rebirth, and you would achieve a state where you snuffed out all of this and achieved, you know, an end of samsara, the opposite of samsara, nirvana. There was a punk band in America some years ago. Did you know? Nirvana. Is it the right name, punk? No, grunge. It was called Grunge Band, I think. People in America know those names, but they don't know what they mean. Oftentimes we know, we use this. You go to a vacation in Bahamas or something, and how was your vacation? Oh, it was nirvana. Do you ever use the word like that here in Singapore? No? But you know what I'm talking about. You might have heard it. So the third noble truth was talking about the cessation of suffering, which sometimes is associated with nirvana. But from the Buddhist perspective, there is a greater state to achieve than simply escaping from cyclic existence, from achieving nirvana. The Buddha said that that's kind of a way station on the way to the ultimate goal of bodhi, the word that you'd also used, enlightenment. You'd said that nirvana might mean kind of enlightenment, right? Generally, we differentiate between nirvana and bodhi. Bodhi is related with the word Buddha. Buddha means enlightened one. Bodhi means maybe enlightenment. There's a city where the Dalai Lama is right now that I mentioned at the beginning, Bodhigaya, where the Buddha achieved Bodhi 2,500 years ago. When you achieve, if you have a chance of achieving nirvana, you might jump at it. You might think, oh yeah, let's get out of samsara. But if you were to have been exposed and have cultivated compassion for others, really recognizing every other living being, not only humans, animals, bugs, spirits, gods, hell beings, all of them are in this cycle of constant change, taking rebirth, dying, taking rebirth again. The beings that are in hell have sometimes been our companions, our friends, our family, our mothers. The bugs, our animals, our dogs. If you think about it, why is that particular animal your dog? Is some karmic relationship to you? You may have been the child of that dog in a previous life and been cultivated by it, fed by it, and now you feed it. It's receiving some karmic recompense from that. There is no way that this group of people here, all of you, this is not the first time we've met. You might say, well, I don't know anyone. I know her or him. I don't know you. I never met before. There is no way that we could be here together listening to this virtuous subject with an open mind and an aspiring mind for virtue. No way unless we created the karma in the past. So when one begins, if one has maybe been interested in achieving nirvana, but one has also been introduced to compassion and the fact that we are exactly equal to all other beings in wanting to be free of suffering, wanting to have happiness, one can develop a state of mind that the Buddha called bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, to want to not just simply escape from samsara, but to achieve the elimination of every last defect from the mind, to become a Buddha, so that one can provide teaching and guidance, and spontaneously, without effort, without having to think, having an omniscient mind that manifests in whatever way is necessary, leading people successively, maybe over many, many millions, billions, trillions of lifetimes, out of suffering into maybe first nirvana, maybe then enlightenment, or maybe directly to enlightenment. In America, there's an expression about the wise person who is crossing the countryside, who knows where the rivers are, would never cross a river twice. You know, sometimes a river will split. Say at one point it's one river, then it splits. So it's much more skillful to cross where the river has, before it splits, you just have to cross once. Otherwise, you have to cross it once, and then after some time, cross it again, right? So that example is, Buddha gave something like that for these two goals of nirvana and enlightenment. One way might be to first achieve nirvana, but one would remain in that state, mental state, for a very, very long time, eons, very just blissfully oblivious of the suffering of the world until one's concentration diminishes, one is instigated by the Buddha to again look at the situation, and one would then take rebirth again, not now out of karma and delusion, but out of prayers, enter into the world, create the causes to achieve enlightenment, like crossing the river the second time to the state of enlightenment. Or, from the very beginning, you can follow the path that doesn't aim from the beginning for nirvana, but aims for bodhi immediately, the bodhisattva path. We'll be talking about that in the succeeding days and weeks. So the third truth is sort of, now this is the solution. A doctor says, okay, I can cure your cancer. George, I can cure your cough. You know, just take this medication. So what is the method to achieve that cessation? We've gotten three truths. Truth of suffering, truth of cause of suffering, that's the problem. The ultimate solution is cessation. We can end rebirth, uncontrolled rebirth in samsara, get rid of all of the delusions. What is the cause of that? The Buddha said the true path, the truth of the path. The word path, like road, or what is path in lorong? What does lorong mean? Lane, right? Is there another word that's more like in Singapore that means path? Something smaller than a lorong? What are we, lorong 25A here, right? It finally dawned on me. I've been here so many times before that means lane. Oh, now I understand. So, I don't know. So path. Path. A path is where is some method, something maybe a location that gets us to a desired destination, right? We could say the path to enlightenment. There's a Tibetan word for path, Lam. There's a very common Chinese name too. Is there a Mr. Lam here by any chance, or Mrs. Lam? Lam, Lam. There's a Tibetan word that means path. And so we talk about the Lam Rim, the graded, the stages of the path to enlightenment. So the path here, when the Buddha talked about the path that leads to cessation, he didn't mean a particular location, you know, a particular place, secret book you get, and, oh, I have to go to some place in Kashmir and that mountain and step on that stone, and then I'm on the path. It's not that kind of path, right? It's a mental path. A mental path that leads to cessation. What is that mental path? Well, it goes back to the cause of suffering. So we had these two related. We had suffering and the cause of suffering related. We had cessation and the path that leads to cessation are related. But also they're related this way. Suffering can be ceased. First, third truth. The cause of suffering itself has a solution, and that is sort of the antidote of the cause of suffering. The antidote of the fundamental kleshas. What's the antidote? What can prevent our anger, attachment, pride, low self-esteem? What can prevent them from rising? Well, one has to investigate. Why do they arise? Why do we get angry? Why do we have attachment? Why do we have pride? Why do we feel, you know, I'm not sure what other word you use now, the low self-esteem. What's another word for that nowadays? Do you know what I mean by low self-esteem, where you put yourself down and I'm so bad, I'm nothing? Depression, one kind. What is the cause of all of these? The Buddha's insight was that this, all of these arise because of the appearance to our mind of our own ego identity, our own self, our own atma. Have you heard that word, atma? You've heard atma. What does atma mean? Soul, yeah. It's in the Western world, like say in Christianity, it's assumed that human beings have souls, right? That, you know, I think Thomas Aquinas or one of the great Christian theologians said there was no reason to doubt the existence of the soul. All you had to do was just watch your own mind. You know, it was obviously there, something that was unchanging, independent of the body and mind, that even when this body disintegrated, your soul might go to heaven, or if you were damned, would go to hell, right? In Indian philosophy that was prevalent at the time of the Buddha, also there was belief in the Atma. But the Buddha's insight was very revolutionary. Only philosophy that had ever exhibited this particular truth of anatma, no self, selfless, that we are selfless. You might say, wait a second, what are you telling me? I don't exist? What's your name? What's your name? Lam. Ah, you didn't say, when I asked, is anyone named Mr. Lam, you didn't answer before. Okay. I'm teasing. So Lam. If I say Lam, you immediately recognize, because that's you, right? Oh, so who is Lam? Who is Mr. Lam? You say, I. There was a famous Indian saint who died maybe 40, 50 years ago. I can't remember, in a mountain, near a mountain in India, that used to have a technique. We'd have the students sit for hours, all night, asking each other, "Who are you? Who are you?" And the person would say, "I am a doctor." And, "Well, I am this, this." So, who are you? What is the, when you think of me, Lam, who is that? At this moment. Yeah. So, if you look in your own mind in meditation, and this is what the great yogis and yoginis, this is the enterprise that they would engage in, to recognize how the self is appearing to the mind. It's not obvious at first. We have a superficial, you know, if you ask it first, who are you? You might say, I am a medical technician, I'm a truck driver, I'm a sanitation engineer. That's in America. You can no longer say garbage collector. You have to say sanitation engineer. More politically correct. So you don't see these low-sounding jobs, you know. I wouldn't mind being a garbage collector. That'd be a noble profession, cleaning up the messes. You might associate yourself with some profession, or you say, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a student. But then if you delve further, you say, well, no, me, there's a sense of I within my own mind that if offended, suddenly anger can arise based on that perception of the self, the ego, the soul, the atma. Not only the perception of it, but the belief that it's really true the way that it's appearing to your mind, that there's a real self behind there animating, kind of like the experiencer of what the eyes see, what the ears hear. Example I've given sometime before is I noticed in the office they have a big television screen with, I'm not sure how many, maybe 12 different pictures from surveillance cameras. You know, they have that in big office buildings also, right? So there might be some, in an office building, there might be some gentleman or gentle lady in the basement watching these, you know, like passively. That's kind of like the Atma. That's what we think of as the Atma, who's watching what the eyes are seeing, what the ears are hearing. Like this surveillance camera, this surveillance camera, this surveillance camera, this surveillance camera that's tasting tastes, this surveillance camera that's experiencing tactile sensations. And the self is that which knows those things, independent of them, kind of, right? That might be one kind of perception of the self, if you think about it. But the self seems to be something that's really there, existing from its own side. The Buddha said that if you investigate, that self that is appearing to be that way does not exist that way. It is empty of existing that way. That is to say, there is no self like that appearance. And you might say, well, how can it appear and not exist? Well, the many examples the Buddha gave. Have you ever been fooled by a reflection? Or maybe, anyone have a parakeet or parrot here? Is that something you have in Singapore? The little bird, parakeet, canary? You don't have? Oh, okay. She doesn't have it. You have. Okay. Sometimes you put a little mirror in their cage. They'll talk to the mirror. It's as though they think the reflection in the mirror is another bird, right? When I was in India at one time, a lady told me a story where a Western lady who had gone to India, and she was kind of dirty, and she wanted to go to a nice hotel. So she first went to an inexpensive hotel to shower and put on some nice clothes. She put on her nice dress. And then she went to the Hilton or whatever it was in Delhi or something. And as she's walking in, out of the side of her eye, she sees another lady wearing the exact same dress. Oh, for guys, it's not so important, right? I don't know. Maybe Singapore men are different. But for the, some people, that's, you know, like, well, how did she get the same dress? She looked, and for a second she was fascinated, and she recognized that wasn't another lady. That was her reflection in one of these big glass doors. You know, in the big hotels, they have these huge glass doors. Very clear reflection. She had assumed that reflection was another person. Why did she assume that? Because it appeared that way. And there is a, in our experience, generally, when we're not looking into a mirror, when we see something that appears some in some way, it's not just an assumption, we believe that is true. So the Buddha gave the example, many other examples also, gave the example of a reflection to give you an idea how something can appear to be some way, but not exist in the way that it appears. So he said that this self that is appearing there, although it appears, it doesn't exist in that way that is somehow really there, findable, if you search for it. If you search, so another example, mirage. Do you know what a mirage is? Is there a slang word in Singapore for mirage or a Singaporean Chinese word for mirage? You know what a mirage is? What is a mirage? An image? Like what? Do you ever see mirage in Singapore? When it's very hot? I the thing I'm thinking of is when I'm driving on the highway sometime, when the highway, the asphalt is very hot and the light reflects and it looks like there's water and you might put on the brakes but there was no water there. Is that what you're thinking? Something like that. Or in the desert, you're delirious looking for water and you see the same kind of thing, the distortion of the light that because of the temperature difference between the ground and the air above it, the light refracts into your eyes and it looks like a reflection, so you think there's water there. If you, although it might look like there's a body of water there, as you get closer, there's nothing there. If I said that that mirage was empty of water, linguistically, would that make sense to you? There was no water there, right? Although it appeared to be water, it was empty of water. So in the same way, the Buddha said this ego, this atma, if you search for it, if you get closer, you'll find that there's nothing there. It's an illusion, like a mirage. Does that make sense? I'll mention one other simile like this. The Buddha said that. Oh, yes, yes. So the self, the appearance, say, we say the Atma is empty of a self. Although it appears, like just as the mirage appears to be water, but as empty as water, this Atma that we're perceiving, this sign of self, looks like it's really there, but it's empty of the self that we're that seems to be appearing there. Does that make sense? Okay. So third example, final one. There's many more others. Echo. You know what an echo is? When you say, say you're out somewhere in a valley, and you say, "George, you're stupid." I say that. And then that sound goes off and reflects off some stone cliff, comes back. A couple seconds later, I hear, "George, you're stupid." Who said that? I can call myself stupid. No one else should call me stupid. You know what an echo is, right? Reflection. So I'll give you some life experience of my own. When I was at my monastery in Wisconsin, in America, where I was living for some years, late at night I would be out finishing up my prayers, saying my mantra, walking down the road. Across the road was a farm where there was this very sad dog who had was so naughty that someone, you know how sometimes people cut the tendons of the legs of the dogs that are chase them just out of cruelty? Either that or the dog had been hit by a car that it had been chasing, so it could only drag its legs behind. Do you know what I'm talking about? So it was barking at me, as always the case. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, is barking at me and running. And it would bark, and then I would hear from over, it looked like another farm over the other side of the monastery, a bark, and then a third bark. And then he or she, I think it was a she would bark, and that dog would bark, and that dog would bark. Amazing, they're just causing all this chaos. And then as I'm going back and forth, as going on, every time, if this one barked twice, they barked twice. This barked once, it was once. Wait a second. There were no dogs over there. Those were echoes. And it just struck me, it was that kind, that's why the Buddha gave these similes. This self that appears, and I believe so much, not only was it appearing that there was a dog over there by the sign of its mark, the mark of its bark, sign of its bark, but I believed that. It appeared and I believed. The same way this self appears and I believe that, but it is just like the echo. It's possible for something to appear and be believed, but to be empty of what we believe it to be. Like a mirage, like a reflection, like an echo, many other examples. So the solution to the klesha is the path that leads to cessation. And the path that leads to cessation is the meditation on selflessness, the lack, the emptiness of the self, of the person, and even the emptiness of outer phenomena that seem to be really there. You know, this you might say, this is, George, this is different than the self. Maybe I can go out on a limb and say, maybe the self doesn't exist, even though it appears, but come on, this cup, this nice Chinese ceramic cup, how can you deny it? It is really there, right? It breaks or it doesn't break. It holds my water, which I need right now. Changeable suffering. In the Buddhist teachings on the perfection of wisdom, it is called the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the Buddha said, not only is the self an illusion, not only is there anatma, no self, but there's no phenomena other than the self either. Are you familiar with the Heart Sutra? The Heart of Wisdom Sutra? You may have recited it. It's very, very famous in Buddhism. Do you know there's one refrain in there? Shariputra, who is a disciple of the Buddha, so who is amongst his disciples who were aiming for nirvana. He wanted to just to achieve nirvana. He was what was called a shravaka, a listener, a hearer. And he was in discourse with Avalokiteshvara. This is the statue behind me is of one emanation of Avalokiteshvara, fully enlightened Buddha. But one of the Buddha's disciples was a bodhisattva called Avalokiteshvara. He was aiming for Bodhi. So Shariputra, who was the best of the Buddha's disciples on wisdom, on the Hinayana path, the lesser path, he asked Avalokiteshvara, how do the bodhisattvas meditate on the perfection of wisdom, which is the, let's say, the path that leads to the cessation of suffering? And Avalokiteshvara said, the bodhisattvas meditate on the emptiness of the aggregates also, this famous phrase. What does that mean? The skandhas also. Makes no sense, right? What is he talking about? When you talk about the person, as I talk about Mr. Lam over here, we've got him. Okay? So Mr. Lam, if you ask what Mr. Lam is, Mr. Lam is somehow associated with his form aggregate, his form, his body. He's recognizable by that, right? If you see even part of it, even through the doorway, you just see his head, you know, that's Mr. Lam, or if you see that purple shirt with a logo on it, even you don't see the rest of it, you might say, oh, there's Lam over there. That's one part. There are five aggregates to the person. The form aggregate, feelings that he experiences, his ability to discriminate, his consciousness aggregate, and then something where all the rest of the mental factors are added, sort of like all the components. Like if you take apart a car, it has various aggregate parts. You can put all of the steel in one pile, all of the rubber gaskets and, you know, maybe all the leather from the seats, all of the petroleum products in another pile. Do you see what I'm saying? You can divide something up into its various component parts. So like that, the Buddha explained how we are all, if you check, we are all comprised of a certain number of parts, and when you exhaust those parts, there's nothing left. Okay? When you take apart the Mercedes and there's no more parts, you say, well, where's the Mercedes? I was trying to find the Mercedes within all these parts, but I was thinking there must be something, some essence of Mercedes here, like some pulsating thing, the soul of the Mercedes. Same thing with Mr. Lam, same thing with you, same thing with me. If you check within your components, parts, your body, your mind, all the parts of your mind, there is nothing in there that you can find that was what you were hoping to find, the soul, the Atma. You are empty of that. In the same way, this cup, this ceramic cup, is that the right word to say, ceramic? What do you call this kind of cup? What? Mug. Porcelain. Not ceramic, porcelain. This porcelain mug, if you check within it, within its parts, you might think, you might have a mental image of the cup, and you might think, my cup, my beautiful cup, my Ming vase cup, or whatever, as though it really exists there findably. But if you search within it, there's nothing within that that is the cup. In the same way that if you search within the parts, what is your name? Lang. Line. Line. Almost like lane, like Lorong, right? Line. So if you search within line, Mr. Line, you can't find anything that corresponds to the soul or the Atma. It's this understanding that is the true path that one meditates on. When one has an understanding of that through analysis over a long period of time, having created many other causes to make your mind sharp and to eliminate other kinds of distorting conceptions in your mind, when you realize the emptiness of the self and the emptiness of phenomena, when you arise from that, a certain amount of your kleshas have been ceased forever. You've reached a cessation of certain of the delusions. Certain ones will never arise again. And other ones are lessened. And by meditating on selflessness and emptiness again and again, you can reach the state of nirvana or enlightenment. So this is kind of a very special teaching that the Buddha gave that is not found in other religions. The selflessness of the person, it doesn't mean that there's no Mr. Lam, there's no Mr. Line, there's no Miss Chu or whatever your name happens to be. What is your name, Mim? Ang. Ang. Ang? A-N-N. And there's no Miss N or N. You may say, well, my daughter knows me as Anne, my husband. There is an Anne that is simply, if you just say, simply designated to these parts, not findable within your parts, just named Anne, conventionally existent, nominally existent, designationally existent, that exists. That's what's called conventional truth. But the ultimate truth is that there's no an findable within the parts. When one recognizes that, one has an insight into that, the other kleshas lose their power. And eventually when you have a direct perception of selflessness, pure, like the Arya being, seeing that truth directly, that is the beginning of the solution. By meditating on that again and again, you can reach the end of all of the klesha. No klesha will arise at all. You'll never get angry. You'll never be attached. You'll create no karma to be reborn within cyclic existence. And you'll no longer suffer. So that, in a nutshell, or maybe bigger than a nutshell, as a cantaloupe or a watermelon, that's an introduction to the four Arya truths. Okay? Does it make some sense? If I were to give you an examination now, would you be able to say what the four truths were? All right, okay. Well, what you said, yes? What's your name? The. So what are the four truths? Truth of suffering, dukkha. Oh, you have the right order. Second one. What's the cause of suffering? Cessation. Truth of cessation. To cessation, the truth of the path, right? You can say, and the implication is the path that leads to cessation, but the words to cessation aren't there, just like truth of suffering, the truth of the origination of suffering or the cause, truth of cessation, truth of the path. And they're called noble truths because for people who have seen the self, who've realized the self doesn't really exist there, who have seen truth directly, these four truths are unambiguous. They are actually true for them. For ordinary beings like ourselves, or at least for me, they're not yet truths. They're just hypothetical truths. We're going on the assumption, on the level of faith, that they are true following the Buddhist path. Okay? We just got to have a couple minutes left. Let me ask you if you have any questions. Yeah, and tell me your name when you say.
My name is
Shelby.
I have this question
that I
asked.
Yeah.
Could you
hear her? Could you hear her question again? Oh, good. Okay. Good question. So, the subject of selflessness, of emptiness, is difficult to comprehend. The Buddha did not teach it from the very beginning to everyone. He taught more elementary practices to be able to sharpen the mind, because one might fall into just having a superficial explanation, as I've given right now. I've given just superficial explanation. One might fall into the idea that, okay, there's no self, then what am I? But you remember, there is a shabby. Did I say right? Shabby? There is a Miss Shabby. Not the one that your mind, that is appearing to your mind, that seems to be somewhere within your body and mind, or sometimes associated with your body, that someone says, oh, Shabby, you're looking great. Kind of associate with the body. If someone says, Shabby, you're so kind, kind of associate with your mind, you know, the kindness. Or if they say, you're naughty, you know, you might associate it. But if they just say, Shabby, you're a liar, or Shabby, you're a thief, it's not associating with the body or the mind. It's like, really, there's something who's really shabby back there, somewhere, who's being attacked. It's that shabby that does not exist. Shabby still exists as a recognizable, conventional phenomena, nominal phenomena, that's simply labeled to your parts. it sounds very impersonal. Your parts, your aggregates, your body, your mind, your consciousness, your feelings. We can label that collection of parts the same way that we label the Mercedes-Benz to a certain collection of parts arranged in a certain way. We call that Mercedes, right? If they're all separated into different piles, we wouldn't call that a Mercedes. If after you have died, and if in Tibet, as they did the mountain burial, have you heard of that, where they would dismember the body? All the parts are there. You would not be recognized as shabby, right? But right now, with the parts arranged in the right way, still animate, still alive, we can label that shabby. But if you look within the parts, you can't find what we think. When we look at shabby, we think there's someone really back there, the real self. That distinction between simply being labeled, designated, named shabby, and on the other side, the antithesis of that is really existing atma of shabby back there, that distinction is very hard to make. And that's what your question is getting to. So don't worry about that now. It's not as though we can recognize emptiness right now and act the way that a bodhisattva does. A bodhisattva might be here, and if you said something to them offending, you know, you're stupid, or your talk was totally useless. I hope no one feels that pain. Their mind would not, because they don't, their mind would not react in any negative way, not with unhappiness, not with anger, not the way that we do, because we still have the appearance of the self here, and we believe it to exist. That individual who's realized selflessness has recognized that something is appearing like a mirage, like an illusion, like a reflection, like an echo. It doesn't exist there at all. So it's as though the words, angry words, go right through them. They are still able to deliver their report if they were to be a bodhisattva insurance executive or whatever the job you said, whatever job. They can still function in the world, but they function in an optimal way. Okay? we have been in cyclic existence since beginningless time. Difficult to understand what that means. So to think that in one two-hour talk, superficial talk by some ignorant boy, that you could realize the solution of selflessness and leave, I went to ABC, I'm enlightened now, just have to go once. We're beginning on a journey, some of us, to enlightenment, and it may take a very, very long time, but to see the end result, to anticipate that, and to find along the way things get better and better, our lives get better and better, less problem, more ability to empathize with others, to develop our heart, and on the other hand, to work for our own wisdom, to alleviate our own suffering. So that's what we should emphasize right now, that we're a beginner, and to try to implement the teachings as much as we can. It's just 12, and I don't want to go over. Let's just spend a minute in meditation to dedicate. At the beginning, we had tried to motivate to listen to this talk with a good intention. Now, again, calm your mind. Relax your body. Relax your mind. And put your attention back on your respiration. All doubts or, you know, different, maybe conflicting ideas that might have arisen, let go of them. Concentrate on the flow of the breath in, changing out. During this last 2 hours, I have listened to the teachings with an open mind, hopefully, and have heard the Buddha's teachings, and with this positive state of mind of wanting to heal myself and others, I've accumulated some virtuous karma, virtuous actions, that will definitely ripen within cyclic existence in the future. Let me make a firm sort of determination, a wish, prayer, that these karmic seeds not ripen in some superficial happiness that's gone, in changeable suffering in the future, just in some relief. But may all of these virtues I've created become the cause of my continued spiritual development. Day by day, year by year, life by life. As a result of these virtues that I've created today, may I begin to tread the path that leads to enlightenment, finding real inner peaceful happiness for myself and the ability to bring happiness and benefit to all sentient beings. Kind of like when you've received a gift of some money, and you make in your own mind, you make a firm determination, I'm going to put that toward my college fund or for my retirement. It's here, dedicating these merits that they'll bring about our own spiritual development in whatever way they ripen, and in so doing, bring about benefits for all sentient beings. Thank you very much. So it's a pleasure. Thanks for your attentiveness. I will give a there are two talks tomorrow. If you have time, you're welcome to continue. And we'll successively, those of you who are able to come to a couple of the talks or many of them, maybe we'll get a good understanding over these next couple of months of a lot of these different topics.